From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how the future looks for CADA, the organization that manages and develops much of downtown Sacramento. Also, one approach to improving passenger train safety, and The People's Warrior, a new biography of the late Sacramento Congressman John Moss, whose legislation included the Freedom of Information Act. But first, with the end of the fiscal year in sight, California lawmakers last night found money sufficient to pass a budget, and the governor signed it. But how real are those last-minute billions? Joining us with that information and more is Ben Edler, Capital Public Radio state government reporter. He's at our bureau downtown. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
How late did things go on last night?
Well, you know, it wasn't as late as a lot of previous budgets that have gone late into the morning, even as the sun rises. But it was wrapped up in time for midnight, which certainly was a goal of lawmakers. They were losing pay each day. They didn't get a budget over to the governor. So when all was said and done, it was probably, you know, what, 10, 10:30-ish, maybe 11 or so when everything wrapped up.
The lawmakers passed the budget on June 15th, but the governor vetoed it, and Controller Chung said it wasn't balanced, and that was why the lawmakers didn't get paid, because the budget was apparently not balanced. Where did the money come from to come up with an apparently balanced budget?
The first most important source is rosier revenue projections, including $4 billion in additional revenue projections that weren't there before. But in order to make it pass muster on Wall Street so California could do its borrowing to maintain its cash flow, there are triggers, cuts that will be triggered if those revenues do not materialize. So that's the biggest source. There are also additional cuts to the UC, CSU, and court systems, a new $12 registration fee at the DMV that will partially offset the vehicle license fee drop coming on Friday, along with the expiration of a 1% increase in the sales tax. So that's going to slightly offset it. And then it certainly relies on $1.7 billion in redevelopment revenues coming from money from the state's more than 400 redevelopment agencies. Those are going to be challenged in court. Redevelopment agencies and cities are furious about this. And in fact, at one point last night, frustration from a couple of Democratic lawmakers over the redevelopment issue hung up the main budget bill. It stalled in the Senate for about an hour or so. Also, the so-called Amazon tax, that is a measure that will subject online retailers like Amazon to the same sales tax as brick-and-mortar retailers. So those are just some of the many, many things in this budget, and I'm sure we will hear more about them. In fact, Marianne Russ and I, our Capitol reporter, will, I'm sure, be telling you more about them in the coming weeks.
Yes. None of these things that you just described appeared out of nowhere since June 15th. Do we know why they were not part of the budget that was passed just a couple of weeks ago?
Well, if you want to be tongue-in-cheek, you could certainly say that the $4 billion in extra revenues came out of nowhere since June 15th. But in all seriousness, that is really a big part of what made up the gap in the budget. It is assuming or hoping or projecting, whatever word you want to use, that the state's economy will continue to rebound. And much of that money, I think I heard someone say about 40% of that money is already in. It came in this year, and then they're going to be counting on a similar amount coming in next year. And you might wonder, how do you count that money twice? Well, the money that came in extra this year was above what was projected for this year, and so it wasn't included in this expiring fiscal year's budget. And so, no, it's not really balanced to take 2 years' worth of revenues and apply it to the upcoming fiscal year. But even the Democrats who are behind this plan, and even the governor, say it doesn't fully resolve the state's structural deficit. It takes, in their minds, a big bite out of it, about 75%. It was around $26 billion, the deficit earlier this year, and now it's going to be down much, much smaller than that. But, you know, so the budget in the end doesn't go all the way to where they want it to go. And you're wondering, where is this? What's different? The revenues are probably the biggest part of what's different.
I'm talking with Ben Edler, Capital Public Radio state government reporter, about the California state budget. Lawmakers passed a budget at their second big attempt. They passed a budget that was vetoed on June 15th. What are people saying about this budget? Is anyone pleased with it?
The Democrats, they're not celebrating, but they're taking a sense of satisfaction from it, as Daryl Steinberg, the state Senate Democratic leader, the president pro tem of the Senate, said. And here's what he was talking about last night as things were wrapping up. He spoke with reporters and discussed his party's, in his mind, ability to get the job done despite Republicans, as he is going to put it, paying more attention to their no tax pledge. Or it would help if I started the soundbite and turned it on.
Okay.
Everyone I know has their own truth, but the facts are the facts. The majority party, both under Republican governor and Democratic governor, have governed. We have stepped up and we have made decisions that we hate because there's less money and we have to do the very best we can with what we have. The minority party has sat on its hands and sat on its pledges and has refused to participate in governance.
And what do Republicans say in response to that?
Well, Bob Dutton, the Senate Minority Leader, certainly doesn't agree with that. And Republicans have said, especially Senate Republicans, last week they held a news conference in front of Governor Jerry Brown's office at the Capitol, certainly a symbolic statement, and said, look, there are GOP votes to put the governor's proposed tax extensions on the ballot, but only if there's also a vote on pension overhauls and regulatory changes wouldn't have been done by vote, but pension overhaul, a hard spending cap as well. And so here's how Senator Dutton reacted last night.
I had members of my caucus that worked for a lot of months, spent a lot of time doing pension reform, also looking at doing a hard spending cap that would protect education and pay down the debt. They were also looking at regulatory reform that would help encourage job growth in the private sector and eliminate some of the burden that we're putting on our small business community. So what I'm disappointed in is that here we got 6 months later, and yet not one of those ideas or anything has been included in this budget proposal to really fix the problems of California and get us moving forward again.
What about the governor in all of this? When the budget was passed, when an earlier version of the budget was passed on June 15th, the governor was out of town the next day and vetoed it quite quickly, and the Democratic leaders in the legislature seemed taken aback by that. Was the governor more obviously or at least publicly involved in this version of the budget?
He certainly was. In fact, Monday afternoon, the governor and Senator Steinberg and Assembly Speaker John Perez held a news conference together, the three of them, to announce the, we say budget deal. It isn't the way we were talking about a budget deal for the last several months involving Republicans and all the provisions that we spoke about earlier. But in the end, it is a budget deal between the governor and legislative Democrats. And so the governor was on board on this particular one from the moment it was unveiled to the public, and he will sign this budget perhaps today, perhaps tomorrow, almost certainly by tomorrow, because the new fiscal year starts on Friday.
So he hasn't actually signed it yet, but he's indicated that he will.
Yes, there's no question he's going to sign it. It's just a question of today or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And he may do some line item vetoes. He has talked about potentially doing that in the past. We don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But he's going to sign the budget. We now know what the state of California spending plan for the upcoming fiscal year starting Friday will be.
The governor vetoed the previous version of the budget. State Treasurer Bill Lockyer said that budget was not financeable, and State Controller John Chung also concluded that it was not balanced and on the basis of that, withheld pay to lawmakers. Have we heard from the Treasurer and the Controller in reaction to this budget?
Yeah, the Treasurer is saying this budget is financeable. In his words, that means that he can take it to Wall Street and say there's enough certainty here that the state's going to be able to balance its books, that he can get some financing for cash flow needs and to make the state run the way it's supposed to run. And the reason he's giving for that is that there is a trigger. Like I said, there are cuts that will be triggered if certain revenues don't come in. And for example, even more cuts to the UC and CSU systems. That's the first. There's different rounds of triggers. If between 3 and 4 billion of the projected revenues come in, there aren't any triggers. If there's between 2 and 3 billion, there's a certain amount of cuts made that include the extra cuts to the UC and CSU. If there's less than 2 billion of that extra revenue that comes in, then there will be, amongst other things, the potential for 7 fewer school days from K through 12 districts. And so those triggers are giving, in Lockyer's mind, the certainty to Wall Street that the state's not going to overspend and it is going to be able to pay what it owes. I would add, though, that the amount of revenue that is being projected, if you know, for each of these trigger levels, the expenses, the trigger cuts don't match the amount of revenue that isn't coming in. And that's something that I need to take a better look at over the next few days, and because it's a question that I have.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't pencil out on that end. For the state controller, John Chung, he is walking a tightrope in a way, and he's not going to weigh in on this budget. He said he only weighed in on the last budget because the governor vetoed it, and so authority kind of fell to him. But with the governor signing it, the Department of Finance is going to certify this budget as balanced, and he's going to keep his neck out of it, I guess, from this particular point on. But there are some Republicans who are upset that he weighed in the first place, as 5 Assembly Republicans are asking the Attorney General, Kamala Harris, whether Chung has the right in the first place to figure out if a budget plan is balanced and whether he can stop lawmakers' pay. It will probably influence future budgets, whether it influences legislators' pay from this past budget. You know, I think we'll just have to wait and see.
And as big as the budget was news-wise yesterday, there was something else fairly significant going on at the state capitol, union legislation that the governor vetoed. What was this legislation?
Well, it's called Card Check, and it would make it easier for farm workers to unionize by allowing them to organize by signing a petition instead of the current technique, secret ballot elections. And unions believe that currently there's too much intimidation from employers. The California Farm Bureau Federation, California Chamber of Commerce believe that if this bill were to pass, it would actually allow too much intimidation from union leaders to get farm workers to join their union in a bid to boost union membership. It's a bill that had a very much party line vote in the Senate and Assembly, Democrats strongly in support and Republicans strongly opposed. Throughout the last couple of weeks, farm workers have been, you know, rallying outside the Capitol and saying, "Governor, sign the bill." Yesterday, there were hundreds of them there, and they started outside at the beginning of the day when it was not rainy. As it rained, they moved inside and stood for hours and sat for hours outside the governor's office, and they were down there an hour or so before midnight when Governor Brown announced his veto. The governor then called the president of the United Farm Workers Union, Arturo Rodriguez, who was there on the phone. Rodriguez wanted the governor to come out and speak with the farm workers, and the governor did not. I'm not sure if the governor was actually in his office at that time or not. But farm workers and unions, two major stakeholders in the governor's campaign last year, very frustrated with the governor right now. The business groups who are very likely pleased with the governor is going to need their support if he does go to voters next year, as it looks like he might, and ask for additional taxes. The business groups were going to support the taxes that the governor wanted this year if there was a special election, along with other changes, you know, the spending cap, regulatory reform, and pension changes. So I'm not sure how much of a political calculation in the end it was for the governor, or if for him it was all about policy. In his veto message, he the governor signed the original bill that gave farm workers the right to be able to unionize like this back in his first term as governor. And he said he's not yet convinced that this card check legislation is necessary. He wants to work with all stakeholders to find something a little bit more, I guess, in his mind, moderate instead.
Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio state government reporter, talking with us from our downtown bureau. Ben, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how the future looks for CADA, the organization that manages and develops much of downtown Sacramento. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Talk of the Nation today, Michelle Bachmann wades in Waterloo. The president swims into the debt talks. New York says I do to gay marriage. And Rod Blagojevich packs for prison. All that and more on this week's Political Junkie. Also, where do ideas come from? Talk of the Nation starts at 11 right after Insight. Much of downtown Sacramento is owned by the state of California. The organization that manages and develops that land faces budget cuts. What will that mean for the Capital Area Development Authority's revitalization projects in R Street and elsewhere? Joining us to talk about CADA is the group's executive director, Paul Schmidt. Paul, welcome to the program.
Jeffrey, thank you for having me on your show today.
How does the state budget affect CADA?
Well, first of all, it should be noted that the Capital Area Development Authority is a joint powers authority of the City of Sacramento and State of California and receives no general funds at this time or ever has, for that matter. It runs independently off of the revenues of the apartments that we manage that the state owns in the downtown area. So the impact on the budget from the budget right now derives from the May revise that the governor issued. And that had said that we should look at selling off the CADA properties as a way to generate revenue for the state. So you have to think this is analogous to, in our opinion, selling off the seed corn of the state. There are properties the state owns statewide that cost them nothing to manage, are independent somewhat, but would result in some income to the state on a one-time basis should they be sold.
And you said that was in the governor's May revise.
So now that may have
what
changed.
What happened to it?
Well, as you noted earlier in the program, we're all trying to sort that out right now. The 11th hour last night, quite a bit was changed. It may be that the planning process would still continue, because one of the things in the May revise was not that we had to sell in the next fiscal year, but that we had to come up with a plan for sale in the fiscal year so that those revenues could be counted in the following fiscal year. So we might be considered Plan D or E in the process of trying to balance the state budget in a small way.
But important to note that, in any case, not part of the budget for this fiscal year that starts on July 1st.
Yes.
Okay. You said this would be like selling off the seed corn if the CADA properties, apartment buildings and the like, were sold off. Mm-hmm. Why would that be like selling off seed corn? I mean, why should the state of California even own these buildings?
Yes, going back to the 1960s, the state purchased a good deal of land around the Capitol building to create a campus modeled after the campus in New York, in Albany. And the idea was to build a state office complex and predominantly locate state offices in that area. What happened was is that was only partially fulfilled, and then the property started to deteriorate over time as the state was leasing in the hinterland of Sacramento. There were burned-out buildings. They were boarded up. There was a tenant riot. And out of that came the Capital Area Plan of 1977, which basically said there would be a state development plan that was coordinated with the city of Sacramento, not in spite of the city of Sacramento. A JPA would be set up around that. And one of the trade-offs and considerations for state office development was that CADA would manage, maintain, and develop housing in the area. So even though these properties were off the property tax roll that the state was owning, they were retaining them for future development sites for state offices.
And wasn't this when a certain Jerry Brown was governor?
Yes, it was. It was. And interestingly enough, at the time, it was an urban infill village concept, which really took hold all over the country after the Brown administration. There were many precedent-setting kind of events, solar power, community gardens, affordable housing, a lot of the things that have come to fruition in urban development around the country.
How much land does CADA manage?
Well, CADA manages about 16 blocks of downtown. It's not the majority by any means. And our responsibility is primarily for the retail, commercial, residential, parking, and support of the state office campus. It's somewhat analogous to Sac State, if you can think of the dormitories and the retail spaces within the campus. The state itself develops the office space within the project area, but that, of course, has slowed down because of the economy. The last major project was the East End project, which many of your listeners may know.
Yeah. You said that CADA is self-supporting from the rents paid by the people living in the apartments. Mm-hmm. How many apartments are you renting out?
Well, we have about 784 apartments in the project area. 210 of those, by law, are affordable to low-income tenants. So those people generally make 50% of median or less, or people that make, say, $22,000 a year or less. One of the big impacts in the loss of CADA, from my mind, would be the loss of the affordable housing in the area, unless there was some mechanism set up to retain that affordable housing through its sale. But right now, there's no public subsidy directly for those units. They're basically that we pool all of the rental revenue and then we subsidize the 30% of the apartments.
What happens to any surplus, if that's the right word to use in the case of CADA? I mean,
goes into the redevelopment of the project area. So currently, for example, we have 450 units and five developers working on development sites for the project area that haven't started construction yet. Have basically been stalled by the recession, but we're hoping that we can continue with those projects through this process.
So the state of California does not financially benefit then from those apartment rents because it either subsidizes the cost of running CADA or is plowed back into redeveloping the area.
Which upgrades the values of the state-owned properties over time so that the taxpayers get the benefit of that in their campus.
Yes. You said that the Governor Brown proposed selling off the CADA properties in the May revise. At the same time, the governor has also said several times, I believe, that he's opposed to selling off the state office buildings like the East End Project and then leasing them back over a long period of time. Do you know why there's a difference between the governor's position on the apartment properties and the office properties?
Well, I think he believes that there's a stronger programmatic need, obviously, for the state-owned buildings in the area.
Because the state actually occupies them.
Yes, the state office campus of about 45,000 people in the downtown area, it really is the economic engine, in my mind, of a good part of downtown. And the state benefits by owning their buildings in the project area because of they've been paid for, basically. And so there's not any interest in changing that scenario, as far as I can tell. Selling off the CADA properties would be, in my mind, selling off the future of the project area because as the state continues to grow in population, there's probably still going to be a need for expansion of adjacent properties for state offices, parking, whatever it is.
But couldn't all the benefits that you've described from CADA also come if it was sold to the private sector? I mean, albeit with close supervision or regulation by the city and or the state?
Right. That's certainly something that we're looking at. But I think the issue right now is that we generate about $2 to $3 million in tax increment from our project area that goes back into these new development projects. If you drive around downtown, most of the new development major projects receive tax increments from redevelopment agency, Sacramento Housing and Redevelopment Agency, or CADA. If that system disappears, there's going to be a big impact on the growth in downtown. The growth that creates all those good things like the centralization of transportation, consolidation of state-owned state offices, that kind of a thing.
My guest is Paul Schmidt, Executive Director of CADA, the Capital Area Development Authority, which manages and develops about 16 blocks of land owned by the state of California in downtown Sacramento. And its future is uncertain because of the state of California's budget problems. Why do you think the city of Sacramento would not support the governor's proposal? I mean, where does the city of Sacramento stand on this?
The city of Sacramento, some members of the city of Sacramento's senior staff thought maybe this makes some sense at this point in time to sell off the properties to generate more tax revenue.
Because the city doesn't get any tax revenue right now because it's state-owned.
Well, they get possessory interest tax, but it isn't to the extent they would get otherwise. But what they've discovered as we've talked to them is that the generation of tax increment that we receive in our project area more than offsets the benefit that they would get from receiving taxes through the sale of these properties and the affordable housing that we're providing that in theory they would have to provide in some way through some subsidy.
Can you describe the kind of apartment buildings typically that CADA is running? I mean, you said that a certain portion of them are set aside for below market rental rates. But generally speaking, what kind of properties are we talking about?
Well, I would characterize them generally as B and C grade properties developed between, we have some going back to 1880, but between 1925 and 1980. For the most part, that's the majority of what the state owns. And CADA's developed properties since then, some of which we own on state land under land lease. Some of the other development projects in the area are privately owned apartment projects developed on state land with CADA over time that they might be able to purchase. So it's not a real simple process, but what we've been asked to do, again, is to come up with a system for disposition of properties that makes a logical sense for
you
the state.
You said that a lot of the properties are B and C in the language of mm-hmm. real estate, but are there any buildings that CADA has developed that people would typically describe as being upscale, fancier condo buildings, lofts?
Certainly the private ones that we've done over time. Fremont Mews Apartments is a private project that we developed with the private sector. They own that building now. Dean Apartments, where the governor lived, some people would consider upscale. Jerry Brown had lived there years ago. Certainly we can look at that as a possible sale. Again, that's a 75-year-old apartment building, so it would need rehab probably to bring it to modern standards, but it's a very desirable location, so there's some things that we're looking at like that.
The state might still want to sell the CADA properties. The city of Sacramento, which also is a party to this matter, could benefit financially if the apartment buildings were sold to the private sector. What's to stop them ultimately saying goodbye, CADA?
Well, there's really nothing to that. We have an agreement that goes to 2042 that's a joint powers agreement between the city and state that was crafted in the 70s. And it was basically to guarantee that this part of the city would be maintained by the state as long as the state had an ownership interest in it. Putting that back on the city, I think, would still be a burden to them to maintain the affordable housing, to produce the redevelopment projects that still need to be done in the area. I should mention also, back in 2002, we expanded to R Street at the request of the city. And so we have put up the matching funds for all of the projects along R Street, the streetscape. Those funds would have to be put up by the city of Sacramento if CADA wasn't there, so we're helping them with that. We've got toxic sites that we're cleaning up, brownfields problems in the area that we're addressing. Again, you'd have to find sources of other funding for that. And so that's really the benefit CADA provides the city and the state, is taking care of business in that project area.
Okay. So I guess today's business includes looking through the state budget that was passed yesterday, assuming the governor signs it, and seeing what it says about CADA.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Paul Schmidt, Executive Director of the Capital Area Development Authority. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, in the wake of the recent fatal train crash in Nevada, we'll look at one approach to improving passenger rail safety. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow we continue our series on public pensions and pay. You'll hear from the Deputy Chief of the Sacramento Fire Department. Also, what's the latest in the Arab Spring? A Middle East expert at UC Davis briefs us on the crisis in Syria, plus our weekly music feature, Sound Advice. That's Insight tomorrow. Well, as you no doubt recall, there was a horrific train crash in Nevada last week. 6 people died. It appears that what happened was that a truck went through a crossing, crashed into a train at high speed. Joining us with one perspective on how to improve safety on passenger trains is Peter Odland, who's Executive Director of California Operation Lifesaver. It's a nonprofit, public education-focused railroad safety organization. Pete Odland, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about rail safety.
Well, you're not in a position to talk in detail about the crash in Nevada, which is still being investigated, but it does seem that the problem there was a truck going through an intersection, a grade-level intersection, with a train. How big a problem is it that a lot of trains in the United States cross directly over roads with just gates and flashing signs and bells to tell the traffic to stop?
Well, that's exactly true, and for the most part, it's that roads go across railroad tracks, which were usually there first. In the United States, Jeffrey, every 3 hours, a train comes in contact with either a vehicle or a person. So, in the last decade, 9,000 lives have been lost in the United States, and here in California, we're unfortunately on the top of that list. 95 people last year lost their lives, 29 people at railroad grade crossings, and 66 while trespassing along the railroad right-of-way. And the frustrating part about that is 100% of those would be preventable if people knew and obeyed the laws.
Well, it would cost an enormous amount of money to upgrade all of those grade crossings. So in the meantime, what can be done to make them safer?
Well, I think keeping in mind that to always look for a train, and when you approach a crossing, all of the railroad tracks in America have railroad signs warning motorists that you're going to be crossing railroad tracks. In California, virtually all of our crossings have lights, gates, signs, and signals.
So what more can you do?
Never try to beat a train. Trains are quieter than you think they are. They're sometimes, because of their size, traveling at a much greater speed. I think people sometimes think that trains can stop. It takes a train oftentimes more than a mile to be able to stop. Trains don't have steering wheels, so they're not going to come and get you in an alley or on a street. And a problem that we have more and more in our society, not only vehicles crossing railroad tracks and pedestrians, are distracted people with listening to radios, talking on the phones, texting. So the bottom line message is when you see those crossbucks, it should get your attention to look and listen for a train.
I think it was about 5 years ago the law was changed and it required trains as they were approaching crossings to ring their bell, and that's been kind of an annoyance to a lot of people across the country in the vicinity of those crossings. But has it had a positive result when it comes to reducing deaths and injuries?
Well, I think yes. I think any time of any type of engineering involvement to better engineer crossings is always a good idea. As it relates to the horn, more and more communities are petitioning for quiet zones. And while we don't really take a stance on that, when communities do that, they go in and do engineering studies of each individual grade crossing and improve the engineering aspects of each individual crossing, like higher medians, quad gates. So those are being applied for and being tested, and we'll see how they work as opposed to the horn. And I would say that the engineer is always has the ability and the right to blow the horn when they see something potential on the tracks.
My guest is Pete Odland, who's Executive Director of California Operation Lifesaver, a nonprofit that works on railroad safety. A few weeks ago, your organization had a trucker on the train event in Los Angeles where you took truckers on a train ride to show them the perspective from the train operator's point of view. What's the benefit to truckers of seeing what it's like to be a train operator?
Well, yeah, you know, Jeffrey, I was pretty amazed when I heard the statistic that in California last year, we had 124 collisions at grade crossings. And 11 of those were tractor trailers. And nationally, about 25% of all the incidents at railroad crossings involve a driver with a commercial license. Now, these numbers are significant, but even more so when you consider that truck-train collisions are more dangerous for everybody. The train crews, obviously the passengers, if it's a passenger train, more dangerous for the truck drivers who are kind of used to being the biggest thing on the road and not so much with a train. And they also have a higher potential for community harm and impacts and much higher potential for property damage. So on July 9th, we did get a group of truckers and representatives from the trucking industry on a train in Los Angeles. It was a partnership with BNSF, UP, Amtrak, and Metrolink. We had a camera in the head end, and a live feed to monitors back in the coach to actually show truck drivers what the train engineer had to go through. And of course, they saw people when the gates were coming down speeding through in front of the train. And I think it was a real eye-opener for them to get that perspective.
Your organization is focused on education, but what about the issue of permanent separation of trains and automobile traffic? Do you also lobby for that?
Well, yeah, that kind of goes back into those engineering things. And if you could wave a magic wand and have trains and roads on different planes, that would be great. The unfortunate thing is the expense and money that it takes to do that. There are steps underway, and I'm sure as one of the benefits for potential high speed rail, those grade separations are part of the original construction. But to go back in and start retrofitting all of the railroads across the country would take more funding than you could imagine.
Yes, I can imagine. Pete Odland, Executive Director of California Operation Lifesaver, a nonprofit public education-focused railroad safety organization. Pete, thanks so much for joining us.
You're certainly welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about rail safety.
Okay. By the way, we contacted several other organizations to participate in our discussion today. Amtrak referred us to the National Transportation Safety Board, which is investigating the crash in Nevada. The NTSB told us it was processing our request, but no other word from them yet. We also contacted the Federal Railroad Administration, which declined to participate, citing its role in the Nevada crash investigation. You are listening to Insight. When we come back, a new book about the late Sacramento congressman who wrote the Freedom of Information Act. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Capital Public Radio News today, more information about and reaction to the new state budget, that and more on All Things Considered starting at 4. The People's Warrior is a new book about the late Sacramento congressman who wrote some of the more important legislation of recent decades. John Moss authored the Freedom of Information Act, overcoming government opposition along the way. His other legislation included the Consumer Product Safety Act. Moss's biography also traces his difficult childhood and interrupted education at Sacramento Junior College. The People's Warrior will be published on Friday. The author knew Moss well. Michael Lamov was chief counsel to several committees and subcommittees that the congressman chaired. When I talked with Lamov earlier this month, I asked him how John Moss became interested in government secrecy.
Moss had a natural inclination toward open government, even in Sacramento. In his four years in the California legislature, he took a big interest in publishing legislation well in advance so the public could get a chance to comment on it. And that's the background. And when he got to Washington, he asked for files on discharged employees. In those days, you may remember, there was a Red Scare. And many federal employees in this is 1950s, were fired for disloyalty. Moss asked the Civil Service Commission for the files so he could see whether the charges had any basis. They turned him down flat as a freshman congressman. He didn't like being turned down.
He was elected to the House of Representatives in 1952. You mentioned the Red Scare, and he served there until 1978. Tell us, just more generally speaking, about his political background, his political orientation.
Well, Moss was a hard luck kid. Sacramento played a tremendous role in his life and his background. He grew up in the Depression. He couldn't finish college because he didn't have the money. He had part-time jobs. He drove a hearse for a while. He worked collecting bad debts for a tire dealer. He lived in a little loft with his brother. He didn't have enough money to buy much food. his mom died when he was 12 years old, and his dad had alcohol problems. So the kid, he was basically on his own. He was one. So that hard luck beginning gave Moss a feeling for the underdog, a feeling for the little guy.
And he was a Democrat.
Moss was a Democrat, but he won election first to the California State Assembly in 48, and then to the United States Congress, defeating incumbent Republicans. It was an amazing upset. The people of Sacramento took an immediate liking to John Moss. I'll just give you a little story. One of the chapters of my book, which is due out July 1st, that's a plug. One of the chapters is called "I Went to Bed a Loser," and that is what Moss told me when I interviewed him shortly before his death in the 90s. He was trailing in the congressional election all the way through the evening, way behind a gentleman who later became the mayor of Sacramento. A very strong candidate, a Republican candidate, to take this seat. There was an open seat for Congress. He had defeated a Republican for the state assembly. Anyway, he went to bed. He was ready to concede. But Jerry Wymore, who a lifelong Sacramento resident, was his campaign manager. And Jerry said, wait, Mr. Moss, don't send the letter yet. Maybe you'll come through with the votes from the outlying districts south of the city, the agricultural districts. And sure enough, early in the morning, he came from behind and pulled it out by 0.4%. That's 0.4 of 1%, zero. Sure. 0.04. And he was elected to Congress, but he was then reelected to 12 more terms. The voters of Sacramento never turned against him, and they supported him in his very, very difficult fights in Congress.
My guest is Michael Lamov. He's author of The People's Warrior. It's a new biography of the late Sacramento Congressman John Moss, who wrote some very significant legislation, including the Freedom of Information Act and the Consumer Product Safety Act. And Lamov was chief counsel to Moss for many years when he served in Congress. How did other lawmakers react to the Freedom of Information Act?
Now, that's interesting. Moss had to fight against his own party to some extent to get, it's called FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, to get it through. First of all, people should understand that when John Moss came to Washington, there was no right to get government information, not documents, not charts, not studies. It was really up to the individual agency, and most of the time they stamped it with a technique people called silly secrecy. The Navy telephone directory was secret, and a report on new uses for the bow and arrow was considered a military secret. That's the danger of secrecy. Moss didn't like it, and he had support. Surprisingly, at first, he was alone. The whole fight took 12 years to get FOIA through, but President Eisenhower blocked it. He didn't. No president likes it. When Johnson was president, he didn't like it. Well, the Republicans noticed that the press was kind of fired up about getting a FOIA bill through, and a lot of citizens too. So Donald Rumsfeld, a pretty famous Republican later in life, was a freshman congressman. He asked to go on Moss's committee, and he and Moss formed a sort of a bipartisan alliance, and I met Rumsfeld and talked to him about a year ago, and he's in the book. There's a long story about Rumsfeld and Moss, and I won't tell you what it is now, but it's and includes Abu Ghraib, the torture memos also. But Rumsfeld supported Moss, and they embarrassed Johnson to signing the bill, basically. Bill Moyer says when Johnson had to be dragged kicking and screaming to sign FOIA, he said, "What is John Moss trying to do to me, wreck my administration?" So, but it was finally signed, and it became law. And over the years, it's been used by hundreds of thousands of Americans and many, many reporters and to write stories about things like hazards to the public health and threats of war and other things. Moss thought that the First Amendment to the Constitution, which, you know, guarantees the right of the free press and free speech, could not be effective without information. And that's why he was so strong on freedom of information.
His other most important piece of legislation was the Consumer Product Safety Act. What was the story behind that? Did he have some personal experience with as a consumer that led him to that legislation?
That's interesting. There was a guy in the Senate named Warren Magnuson, who was the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, who set up a national commission, which I happened to be by a bit of luck happened to become general counsel to. So when the commission issued its report, it found that 30,000 people were killed every year and 110,000 permanently injured. This is the 1970s now. We're moving about 20 years forward, and Morse has already achieved FOIA. So instead of relaxing, he turns to this issue raised by the National Commission. So I was looking for a job. The commission was ending. It was only a two-year commission. We had some hearings in California and down in L.A., and we got a lot of people interested in this dangers around the house, toys, sporting goods, lawnmowers, electrical products. A lot of people injured and killed, and a lot of over $5 billion in annual costs due to product injuries. Moss picked it up in the house, and it was dead before he picked it up. And when I needed a job, so I called him and asked him. And now I'm from New York, and I went to school in Boston. So here's a California congressman, and I called him on the phone and said, could I come to work for him on the bill? And he said, yeah, he didn't care where a person was from.
It sounds like Congressman Moss would swim against the tide somewhat, because with FOIA, he was going against basically the preference of a lot of government, a lot of politicians. And with the Consumer Product Safety Act, I'm sure there was no end of companies, corporations that did not were not happy about that bill.
Absolutely. He had some help. There were some companies that had made a very good product that felt they would benefit from a safer product. But they were the minority. I would say, by and large, they wanted a weak compromise. That was the way they handled it. They didn't oppose it. In the 70s, consumer protection was king. And even President Nixon signed the bill ultimately after Morse managed to squeeze it out of the Congress. It was very hard. But Nixon signed it with a glowing statement that he thought was a wonderful idea, even though he behind the scenes fought it all the way. And the story's told in the book about the ways they tried to kill the bill or change it. But Morse was tenacious. He never gave up, and he sometimes stepped on the toes of his own leadership. He was on the leadership track to be Speaker of the House, perhaps. Sam Rayburn loved him, and it's in the book. The story's in the book. He ultimately got off the leadership track. He never told me exactly why, but I have a feeling that when after he fought them on FOIA and basically disobeyed Johnson's instructions to sidetrack the bill, there was no way that he could serve the leadership. He was not a yes man. John Moss was a Westerner. He was an independent fellow. As I said, he had a hard life, but he fought for the people of Sacramento, and ultimately, the things he did were great for Sacramento, for California, and for the world. There are now 60 countries that copied the United States Freedom of Information Act. And every state of the union has an open records law, including California. Many didn't have it. Most didn't have it when Morse went to work way back then.
Mm-hmm. Michael Lamov, author of The People's Warrior. It's a biography of the late Sacramento Congressman John Moss. Moss's legislation included the Freedom of Information Act, and Lamov was chief counsel to Moss for part of his time in Congress. Michael Lamov, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And The People's Warrior is published this Friday. That's Inside for today. Today's associate producer, Sosin Marar, Liz Cazares, and Lynn Weaver. The assistant producer is James Morrison. Inside's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. I'm Jeffrey Callison, and we'll be back tomorrow. Thank you. On the next Insight, we continue our series on public pensions and pay. You'll hear from the Deputy Chief of the Sacramento Fire Department. Also, what's the latest in the Arab Spring? A Middle East expert at UC Davis briefs us on the crisis in Syria. Plus, our weekly music feature, Sound Advice. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.